All right. Open your Bibles to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. Tonight we're speaking on verse 32. Just one verse that we're going to focus on tonight. Ephesians 4, 32. Now, Ephesians 4 is Paul the Apostle writing a letter to a church. That's the important thing to understand here. And not just an insignificant church. The church at Ephesus was a very important church, a large church, a successful church, a great church. So this great church, a strong church, so many had gotten saved, and Paul had spent years of his life ministering to them and helping them grow. So this wasn't just some little tiny church, and it was an established church. And Ephesians chapter 4 is a manual for the church. Right? You go through the chapter, and it's verse by verse how a church should act, how we should do things, how we should act one to another, what we should do in the world, how we should reach others. It's a how-to manual for the church, right? So here we're speaking to a church. In Ephesians 4:32, it says this, "And be kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven you." Now, I ask you, if this is such an amazing church filled with amazing Christians, why then does Paul have to spend time telling them to forgive one another? Right? Isn't it kind of implied by what he's saying that the people in this great church are, well, mistreating one another, right? If there was no mistreatment one towards another, there wouldn't need to be forgiveness, right? And so here we have this church, and he's trying to encourage these Christians to live in a great way. He wants them to go beyond. And in the whole context of Ephesians is how he wants them to mature in Christ, and he's looking forward to this amazing future for these Christians, for this church. And so he gives them this manual, and he's telling them that they need to forgive one another. Fact is, the church at Ephesus was not a perfect church. I hate to burst your bubble, but this isn't a perfect church. That is to say, although we have a perfect Savior, the church is made up of imperfect people, right? Who sometimes don't always treat each other the way we should. And so some Christians think, I'm not being treated the way I should here. Things aren't going perfect in this church. I'll just maybe find another church, right? And the thoughts that I go find another location, there I'm going to thrive. There I'm going to do better. But Paul isn't encouraging to them. He's not writing this saying, hey, there's issues in the church at Ephesus. If any of you guys are spiritual, go find another church, start another one. It's not what he says. He says they ought to be tenderhearted and forgiving one another. So tonight I'm talking about, here's the title if you want for the live stream there, Thriving in an Imperfect Church. Thriving in an Imperfect Church. The Bible says, be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Now, when we plant plants, we want them to thrive, right? The farmer plants an apple tree and wants it to thrive and grow fast. The crops that we plant, we want to thrive. This year, I've been doing a little bit of teaching for the school, helping out, covering some bases there. And the last few weeks, I've been helping teach some seventh and eighth graders, some science, right? So we've been going through biology and learning about plants and how different plants and animals thrive in different environments. You know, we teach, you know, there's certain plants that they thrive in the desert, right? So these cactuses and tumbleweeds and Joshua trees and things like that out in a desert environment where most plants don't thrive. There are certain ones that thrive fantastically there and they grow. You plant those same plants here and they kind of get out-competed by the other plants around here and they don't do so well. There's other plants that thrive in a jungle environment and in a jungle climate, a tropical climate. And those plants grow fantastically in huge trees. Have you ever seen a rainforest and how enormous the trees grow there? And the trees do very well there. But those same trees, you plant them in Alaska, they're not going to do so well, right? They don't thrive in that environment, right? And so now, of course, I'd like to have some trees on my property. So I buy some plants and go to a nursery, and I'm not going to look at that plant and I'm like, where's the perfect climate where this plant will thrive? That's not what I do. Because guess what? I'm going to go plant it in my yard. And my yard isn't a perfect climate, right? The plant might thrive in a more tropical climate, but too bad. I'm going to plant it in my yard because that's where I want it to thrive, right? The plant doesn't get to pick the weather around it. You understand that, right? I want the plant to thrive. Yes, my yard's not perfect, right? It's got this hard Dover clay soil. You know, it's just the way it is, right? And that's that, you know, my trees would rather have a nice soft moist soil, but they get hard clay soil. That's what they get, right? And the trees may not like the winter, but too bad. You know, they're going to have to deal with it, right? I have an imperfect climate, an imperfect environment, but yet if you go to my house, you'll see plants that are thriving. And so the question is not whether you've found the perfect church, but are you going to thrive in the church God put you in? It may not always be the perfect environment. People might always not always treat you the way you want to be treated. They might not always say the perfect things to you. They may not always respond to you as they should. The leadership, even in a church, may not give you everything you need to thrive. But can you thrive in an imperfect church? Well, God's plan for the church was for it to be made up of imperfect people. You go ahead and keep looking for that perfect church, you're not going to find it. You can jump to a new church every 2 or 3 years if you like. Some people do, but they find the same problems at every church they go to. You know, at some point, they have to realize the problems are following them because, there might be a common thread to all the churches you've been in, you. Okay, but the fact of the matter is, how do I, in a church that's not perfect, how do I get along, right? How do we not have conflict? How do we not tear ourselves apart? Those that do always looking for the greener grass church, that jump to a new church every 2 or 3 years, they get to a church and at first they're so excited, right? All these new faces, all these amazing things, and all this potential, and you see the things that are good in this church that were not perfect in the last church you were in, and you're like, oh, this is so exciting, But it wears out. There's this phenomenon where it kind of wears out after a while, and pretty soon you notice the imperfections, and pretty soon you build up struggles, and now you started off, oh, this is great, I like everyone here, and then after a while I don't like them because of that, and then I can't get along with them, and I don't dig their personality, and then that time they cut me off, and pretty soon your acceptable group within the church shrinks and shrinks until you're not content in the place where God planted you. And I think this verse is a key to this church. That in this passage, Paul finishes up with saying this because the church needs this. And every member of the church needs to learn this fundamental truth. If I'm going to thrive in an imperfect church, interacting with people that are as imperfect as I need to have a tender heart. I need to have a tender heart. So let's look at this verse. We'll just spend a few minutes really looking at this verse, looking at every word in this verse, understand it, and then I just have four questions to ask to kind of apply this verse, okay? So the verse says, and be ye kind one to another, and be ye kind. Okay, that and is there for a reason, because the previous verse says this. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, right? And I really think that is there with an and, because we need to do all those things, get rid of that. That has to happen first, right? It's a base level. If we're going to get along in a church, right, filled with imperfect people, and we're not going to be at each other's throat, we can't have anger, wrath, right, bitterness. These things destroy relationships, and it's pretty obvious how they destroy relationships, right? It doesn't need all that much explanation to understand that there's anger and clamor, evil speaking, gossip, right? If we're sitting there gossiping about each other, speaking evil, oh, that guy, did you hear what they did? Oh, well, I don't know if I like this church member. You know, that deacon, look what he did last week, you know. We understand that if that happens in a church, we're just going to fall apart really fast. And if you're doing that, not only will you not thrive, but you're going to stunt the growth of the entire church, right? So we can't have that at all, right? Kind of step number one is let's put that away. Like says, but look, let it all, look, be put away with all malice, right? There's no place in a church for actions to get back at someone. Well, they disappointed me here, so guess what? I'm not going to show up and help them with this. You know, I'm not going to do this malice. I'm going to do something intentionally to put something difficulty in the life of another person. Like, there's no place for that, right? Once we're at each other's throats, once we've picked sides and it's us versus them, all right, we don't have a church, we have a brawl, okay? That just falls apart, right? So we know that, but and then we kind of obviously, when we think about, okay, the church has got to get along, we have to have unity in church, we do focus on this list of things. Often we do. We're like, okay, our church needs to get along, we need to make sure we don't have any gossip and any of this malice towards one another. We can't let any bitterness towards each other grow, and we can't lose our tempers to get angry at each other. And we know we got to get rid of these things. But my point here is this and, the first of our verse, is showing that although getting those things, the things we think of as creating disharmony, we got to get those out of the church, right? That's not sufficient. We have to. Yes, first, let's get those out. Let's just not do it, okay? Let's just not gossip. Let's just not be angry at each other, okay? There's no place for that in a church, right? Where we're all children of God, forgiven by God, right? We got to put that away. But then we have to do something instead, right? We can't just say, okay, well, we're not doing those things, so we must be getting along just great. No, you cannot be doing those things, right? We're not losing our temper. We're all acting very nice. We're all acting very civil towards one another. You know, we're not coming here. We're not mean. We're not tripping one another. We're not keying one another's cars. You know, oh, we all act here like nice, friendly people, and you know, there's no antisocial behavior going on between. We're not at each other's throats or punching or. And yet, we don't have any unity as a church, right? We can put those things away, and we're not anywhere where we need to be, right? So that's why this next verse is important. We can't just stop at the end of verse 31 and say, well, we've gotten those bad things. You know, we're not gossiping about each other. Okay, good. We got to do that first. We got to put those away. Just get them gone. Okay, there's no question. Now we put those away. Now we need to put something else. This is how we interact with one another in the church, right? So here it is. Here's the manual. So how do I interact with other members of my church? And let us be ye kind one to another. I want you to think about that. It does not say, and act kind one to another. You notice that? It's not saying like, and behave with kindness one to another. That's not what it says. Oh, we know how to do that. We frequently can walk up to someone, right? And we may hate their guts, but we know, like, okay, I'm not going to get very far. I'm going to get in trouble if I talk mean to them, right? You know, like you go down here and you're speeding and a cop pulls you over. You may or may not think it's fair that you're being pulled over, right? But most of us here are smart enough to act kind to the police officer because we know that it's in our financial interest to act kind to the police officer that just pulled us over, regardless of whether we're being kind or not. You see what I'm saying? We may, on the outside, act nice to other people. But that's not all it's saying here. It says, be kind. One of them is this is a outward action. One is a inward state of being. But notice it's be kind one to another. So it's inward, but not inward in isolation. It's this is something I am. I am a kind. This is something that's part of what I've become. This is what down deep inside I am kind, but it's toward another. Look, one another. Not, well, I'm a kind person, right? My kids, I'm really kind to my kids. Well, I'm glad you're kind to your kids. But it says one to another, right? If I am the kind of person that's not, be kind one to another, not just be kind, oh, I'm kind to myself and I'm kind to my dog, right? Sometimes I'm even kind to my wife, okay? But am I kind to everyone in this church? Well, that's a little harder question, right? So it's be kind, not just act, not on the outside only, but it has to be something internal. This is who I am. This is the state. This is who Christ has made me. Not I know how to put on kindness. I know how to act kind because I get in trouble if I don't, right? In the school, they know how to. The same kids that have started, they know how to put on the uniform, right? Right? We don't have to worry about how they dress because it's a uniform they have to wear in the school, right? But that doesn't mean that's what they want to be wearing necessarily, right? And what they put on, I would have no idea what they put on once they get home and stuff like that. The same kind of thing we kind of have in society. We're all people that get along with society. There are people that don't know how to act towards others around them, and they're kind of shunned and says, but But I mean, most of us here, like, we know how to interact with people in such a way we get along, right? We're not the ones being thrown out of restaurants and stores because of how we act towards one another. So we know there are consequences to acting wrong. But now we're saying, on the inside, am I going to be kind? So this kindness towards others isn't just something I put on so that I can get something in return, or put on because that's just what's socially acceptable, it's just what we do. But it's something that's coming from within, right? And it's not just, I feel kind on the inside, you know, I'm just a kind feeling. No, am I being kind towards them and them and them and them, each one of us, right? You don't get to pick and choose. It's one towards another, not towards some of us, right? The idea is towards every member of the church. You're kind, not just on the outside, but on the inside, right? So be kind one another. Of course, this is that's the state we want to be in. We want to be this be kind. How do we get there? Well, the descriptor of what the key ingredient to that, if you will, is this central word in the verse here: tender-hearted. Tender-hearted. And as we go through, I think we'll see what that means. But I need to be tender-hearted. I'll start with this one analogy, if you will, right? I have a pillow on my bed. I picked a pillow that was soft. You go to a store to buy a pillow. You want a tender pillow, right? You don't want to go to, you're not going to get a piece of, you can go to Home Depot and you can get a nice paver brick, okay? Nice and solid, okay? It will last longer than your pillow. It will. And it's stain resistant, you know? There's all kind of benefits, right? But what's the difference between a solid brick and that nice soft pillow? One yields to your head, right? The other doesn't. One changes its shape to adapt to another. Right? Do you see that? They're like the pillow. When I put my head on my pillow, it yields and changes its, there's a preferred shape the pillow has. It springs back to, it wants to have this shape. But when I put my head on it, it allows itself to be bent into a different shape than it would be on its own. And it's okay with that. It's not stubborn to say, this is the way a pillow should be shaped. You change your head, right? Now, the cement paver from Home Depot, put it on my bed, and it's like, this is the way it is. You don't like it? Fix your head, right? You know, your head's too round. That's not my problem. And it's this fundamental nature of, I interact with another person in the church. Does my heart yield for them? Or is it, no, this is the way it is. The problem's with you. You got to change so that you can get along with me, rather than I need to change so I can get along with you. Tender-hearted. All right, here's something else that's tender. Oh, again, with the seventh and eighth graders, we were trying to plant some plants today, right? This morning we were putting plants to seeds because we're learning about seeds germinating, so we put plants in dirt. I wanted some dirt to put plants in. That's just what you have to do in seventh grade, I guess. You know, science involves dirt, and you put a seed. That's science, right? So we were doing that, and I was looking around the house. I was trying to grab some dirt. Now we have lots of soil all around my property. I could have grabbed a shovel, and I could have scooped up some, but I know the dirt in my is clay, okay? It's not very tender, right? Especially right now, right? It's solid and hard. There's no tenderness to the ground around. So I went to, actually, my wife was generous enough to go over to the garage and grab this for me as I was running out the door this morning. And here we go, the Miracle-Gro Moisture Control Potting Mix, right? I borrow this from my wife here. Look at this. Grows plants twice as big. Things thrive in this. Why? Because it's tender. You can feel the squish in the back. I could use this as a pillow. I mean, this dirt here, it's squishy. This is tender soil. I mean, this stuff is, I don't know what is in here, but it's springy. You know, if I drop pellet, you bounce right up. I mean, it's super tender. That makes it ideal for plants. Why? You put a seed in it and you allow it to grow. And guess what? Rather than forcing that plant to conform to whatever's on the ground yields to the plant. This is tender soil. This allows that plant to thrive. Now, have you ever seen a picture of like a tree growing on the side of a mountain, a rocky cliff? And it's amazing. And it's amazing that trees can grow there. But the rock doesn't yield. There are cracks in the rock, and the roots of that tree have to yield to the rock. That's the way the rock is, and it's not moving, and there's this little crack here, and so to hang on to the side of a mountain, a tree has to move its root, and it has to figure out the spot where it can put the root, right? Because the rock ain't changing. There's no tenderness in that. So when I'm interacting with someone else in the church, do I have a tender heart? Do I have compassion towards them? Or is it the other way around? No, they need to adapt to me. So it says, be ye kind one to another. And the key to that is to be tender-hearted. And that says, this is what that actually looks like. So what does tender-hearted look like? Okay, great analogy. What does that look like? Here's what it looks like. Forgiving one another. Forgiving one another. The word forgiving, it's a really simple, and sometimes we have trouble with this. I was asking the kids in kids club the other day, this last week, and okay, kids, what does it mean to forgive? And it's like, it's what you say after someone's mean to you. Okay, that's what you say because your parents said, after you've done something wrong, you say, someone's done something wrong. I say forgive you. Okay, good. Kids know to say that. That's good. What does it mean? I don't know. Look at it. It's really simple. Forgiveness is you don't owe me anymore. Forgiveness is talking about a debt, right? So if you borrowed money, and then someone said, "Oh, you know what? You don't have to pay it back." That's called debt forgiveness. That's what the word forgiveness means. It means you owe someone, and they say, "You know what? You don't owe me anymore," right? And this is the fundamental idea here. I need to forgive one another. There's people in the church that owe me. They need to not. I need to have the state be the state where, look at this, no matter what they've done, no matter how long we've been together, no matter how many mess-ups, they don't owe me anything. And I'm not at that state because I went to them and said, hey, I wanted to settle some score here, and you owe me because you cut me off in the parking lot. You need to do something to make it up for me. No, forgiveness is like, guess what? You don't have to pay it back. You were mean to me. I'm not going to be mean back, and you don't have to be nice to me to make up for it. That's it. You just don't owe me, right? There's no debt to be repaid. There's nothing you have to do to make up for your past failures or your present failures, right? It's forgiving one another. And of course, what's the motivation behind that? Even as God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven you. I love how it says it here. It doesn't just say, just like God forgave you, right? Because God didn't just say, I'll overlook your flaws. Now, catch this. It's so important. We're interacting with people in the church. We're forgiving one another as God did. Did God just overlook your flaws? No, he didn't. See, sometimes we think this, okay, I'm forgiving people in the church, okay, so that means, you know, I'm not getting angry, right? I'm not having that malice and stuff. Like, oh, so, okay, it's okay, you know, they were mean to me, that's all right, I'll handle it. They were mean to me, okay, it's okay. They disappointed me, you know, they made a promise, didn't keep it, I did something nice to them, they didn't say thank you, right? And what we kind of, without thinking about it, here's how we kind of interpret we're forgiving other people is I'll give them a pass, but really here's what we're saying there. I'm not going to go collect the debt. But forgiveness isn't saying I'm not going to collect the debt. Okay? This is important. Forgiveness says the debt doesn't exist. You no longer owe me. Because there's times when hey, someone, like there's credit card companies, you borrow money and stuff, and they say, hey, no payments. And that's how they get you, right? You know, no payments for so many months, right? And they're not forgiving what you borrowed. No. They're going to get it back with interest. Right? They're just saying, I'm not collecting right now. And sometimes we easily think of this as, well, I'm going to overlook, you know, I'll put up with. Forgiveness is not putting up with. Because here's what happens. I want to be a good Christian. Okay, I'll put up with them, right? Put up what they do today. And oh man, there's another little now. And this time they give me a bad look. Oh well, I'll put up with that. And here's what we're doing. We're a little tiny bit by tiny bit that are accumulating debt with you. You're not extracting it out of them. You're not trying to pay them back, right? We put away the malice and the anger and the bitterness. That's you going saying, pay up right now, buddy. But what we're talking about here, but we're not doing that. But very easily, we can let that debt build up. This thing they did that annoyed me, they didn't say thank you. Look, I did something nice to them. So it's not just what they did to me. Look, I said something nice to them, and they didn't even say thank you. Or maybe they said thank you, but come on. They haven't returned the favor yet. Like, I'm always doing nice stuff for them, and what have they done for me? Oh, you know, okay, I'm a Christian. Yeah, we still think that way, don't we, sometimes? Hey, where's the reciprocity here? What do I get out of this, right? I was nice. They've not been nice back. I said hi. They didn't say hi. Put it on their tab. That's what we're doing, right? Oh, we're not being angry at them, but look, we're little by little, we're putting it on their tab. And there's members of this church, if we're not careful, that have rung up a huge tab. And little by little, hey, that debt is growing so much that the sweetness of our relationship starts to die slowly. We get more and more frustrated with those in this church, and more, I'm not thriving in this church. Little tiny things, but we let them add up. It says, forgive, but as God, that's not just as God forgave you. It says, God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven you. God didn't put up with your sin or overlook your sin. It was paid in full on the cross. If God is still keeping tally of all your little mess-ups after that, then the blood of Christ wasn't good enough. It's forgiven. Washed white as snow. As far as the east is from the west, your sin is, he's removed your iniquity from you. He's paid for it all. It's been nailed to the cross. Paid in full. There is no debt. It's not that it's like no payments for 6 months or even no payments for 6 years. It's there's no payment because your balance is zero. And forgiving others, if I have a tender heart to others in the church, just like Christ forgave me, I don't sit there and say, oh, well, I'll put up, you know, you've got a little bit on your account. You've annoyed me a few times, but it's not so bad that I can't get along with you. I can still get along with you. No, that's not forgiveness. Forgiveness is you owe me nothing. And I'm going to interact with you as though there's nothing ever you've done to disappoint me. There's nothing ever I've seen that where I thought less of you. There's nothing you did to build a debt. Because I've forgiven that debt just as Christ forgave my debt. Okay, so we got the idea. If I want to get along in a church, tender-hearted, forgiving one another. But here's the rub. I'm going to talk about as an application here. Four questions I'm going to ask. Because we think, okay, I got this, right? I have compassion. I see struggling people in the church, and there's someone, and they've got issues, and they come into the church, and they've struggled, and they finally come, and they get saved, and you're so excited, and yeah, okay, they've got a rough past and all that, but you know what? I'm so glad they're here. I'm so glad they're saved. And so we look at that example, right, of someone who messed up big time, you know? We forgave him. Awesome. You know, this person that's struggling so bad, you know, And they made so much, you know, the teenager that was wayward and rebellious in the church, and then they came back and got right with God, and now they're back in church. And so we look at that and so pat ourselves, you know, yeah, look at this. I'm forgiving. I had compassion on that person. Someone that walks in the church and they've got problems and disabilities and stuff like that, and we hold the door for them. And so we're reminded when we hear this passage, we say, am I tenderhearted towards people in the church? Oh, yeah, because you can list those four or five examples, right? But I've got four questions for you to see if there's some exceptions to your rule of being tenderhearted. Because tenderhearted isn't just, I have a place in my heart for this person with that problem, this person with that problem. Tenderhearted is I have a heart and a willingness to forgive anyone in the church, regardless of who they are. So here's number one. Are you tenderhearted towards, number one, strange people? All right? So here's the concept here. We have a hard time with compassion when we have a dislike or disgust to the different way someone lives, thinks, or interacts with others, right? You know, we're in a church and we don't get to pick who the members are. Christ saves everyone. Christ died for all. And the implication of that is he died for all and he wants them all in a church, which means that means the really weird people are going to be in your church too, all right? You're going to have to deal with it, right? And here's the fact, right? I can't just say, well, yeah, I'm tenderhearted and stuff for people that like act like me, live like me, but it's a weird person. Someone in the church is tenderhearted as them, right? So there's someone else that's their kind of people, and they'll cover them, and I'll be friends with my kind of people over here. Is that right? We have this. So missionaries struggle with this. I mean, the missionaries know about this, and they're on guard to not struggle with this, right? So if you go to a Bible college and you're training to be a missionary, they're going to spend a lot of time warning you about something they call culture shock. You ever heard of this term? I know, Pastor, you know all about it, right? Culture shock. When you go over to another country, and they have very different ideas of food, what is food and what isn't food, right? They have very different ideas of, like, what it means to clean, like what cleanliness is, sanitation, the concepts of what you do with waste, right, is different in different places of the world, right? Their ideas of just how you interact with people, honesty. And it's not all neutral things. I mean, there's neutral things about culture that, like, okay, that's different. You know, you call it this, I call it that. But there are things that there's generally a problem with that. It'd probably be better for this culture if they weren't that way. But, you know, is it ideal that in some countries, their idea of garbage collection is you find the closest stream and throw your trash into it, right? And until the stream looks like it's just gross, you know, that's not ideal, okay? But here's the thing, if I go there to that country, and they see on my face disgust towards them and the way they live, right? I've just shut down any opportunity of them hearing the gospel from me, right? And so missionaries have to worry a lot about this. They have to, like, prepare themselves for, I'm going to go, and they're going to offer me something, and I need to not be grossed out, right? I'm going to walk into their house, and I'm not going to be able to stand the smell. And I'm not going to be like, why have you gone for 2 years without fixing that hole in the roof? There's water coming straight down. And I need to be just totally fine with it, right? It's difficult. But the thing is, you go over to that country and you think, boy, these people are weird. What you don't know is they're looking at you and thinking, boy, this guy's weird, right? as strange as they are to you, you're that strange to them, right? Because the fact of the matter is you can't go to a church and look, there's going to be people come to the church that aren't just like you, right? And it's not just like they may not, yes, there may be people from a different culture and they come from a very different background for you. There's people with a different sort of family than you, right? They may have grown up in the same city, the same town as you, but each family is a little different. And some families have a few more quirks than others, right? And you might be one of the ones with a weird, quirky family, right? You think you're normal, right? Here's how the world deals with that. The world deals with a situation this way. Look, I can't stand people that are like have. There's things about the way they talk, the way they live, the way they clean their house, or the way. So what do I do? I just find a bunch of people just like me, and we'll clump together, and then we'll all think we're normal, right? That's the world solution, is that you only hang out with people that are a lot like you, and then you all think, oh, we're normal, and the rest of the world is weird, right? And the ones that you were thinking, oh, they're weird, they're hanging out with more people like them, and they're like, we're normal, and all of them are weird, right? This is how the world works, right? But it's a shock then when Christ calls the church, Jew, Gentile, bond and free. I mean, this is a sudden shock. This is totally different than what they were used to. And you see this so much in the New Testament that they're doing this, and it's strange for them because okay, there's suddenly weird people in the church, right? People if it weren't for church, I would never even get to know someone that's like that, right? And yet, I have to seem to just kind of pass by and go hang out with the buddy that's just like me, right? I need to have a tender heart towards even some rather quirky people. Now, some people they think very differently than you, all right? Their view of things is, you know, they have different likes, they have different taste in food, and do I still have a tender heart? Well, what's our verse here, right? Even as God, for Christ's sake. When you think about this in the Bible, let's look at a few examples. Paul, he dealt with people that were weird. Can you imagine Paul going to Athens? Paul grew up as a Pharisee, a Jew. There's nothing more revolting to him. He was raised up to be grossed out by the sight of anyone worshiping an idol. And he goes to Athens, and the entire city is given to idolatry. Right? It amazes him. He has this culture shock as a missionary there. And look what it says. It says, and Paul waited for them in Athens. He sees all this idolatry. He says this, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city given to idolatry. Now, he's not the first Pharisee to move to travel to Athens. There was a whole group of them in Athens. But the other Pharisees, when they came to Athens, they saw all the idolatry and they were repulsed by it, which, I mean, you ought to be repulsed by idolatry. But as they were repulsed by idolatry, they had a hardened heart towards those people that were practicing idolatry. You understand? Those strange people in Athens that were doing something that was anathema to Paul's culture. Yes, it was wrong, but that didn't mean he had a hardened heart. Because here's what it says. He was moved for them. He had a soft heart to them. And he went and he showed them the truth. Right? And so there's going to be some weird people with some weird ideas that come to this church And I can't just pass them up or give them the cold shoulder, right? I should have a tender heart towards them because that's what Christ did. Look at this, what it says here, Philippians 2:5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God. You talk about having a right to judge me. I mean, I might see someone and like, they're a little strange, you know, they got a couple of loose screws. I might think, oh boy, you know, they need some help. Their ideas are pretty weird. But what is it like when God looks at me? For Jesus Christ, it was not robbery to be equal with God. He was God. Omniscient, all-powerful. And I might be quick to say, here's someone struggling with some mental health thing. You know, they've got some kind of autism, or they've got some kind of, you know, this is a huge struggle for teachers, right? I'm trying to help out the school and stuff like that. And teachers, like it or not, you know, you don't get to pick the students in your class. And you're going to have a student, they got some kind of auditory processing thing here. They've got this kind of ADHD, this kind of autism spectrum disorder, whatever they're dealing with, right? And you need to have a tender heart for them. You can't say there and say, well, they don't think the way I think, so come on, get with it, fix it, you know? All these students should all think the way I think. No, it doesn't work that way. And it didn't work that way for Jesus. Imagine him coming to this earth and looking at his classroom. Oh boy, we've got issues. Compared to him, I'm the weird one. And you look what it says. Thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant. Jesus' heart, just like my pillow takes on the form of my head, Jesus took on the form of us weird human beings. When I interact with someone in the church, am I so high and mighty that I tell them to take on my form instead of me taking on their form? When Christ, who's equal with God, took on my form, his heart yielded to where I was at. And so, even as God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven me. So, number one, do I have a tender heart for strange people? Do I have a tender heart for frustrating people? Right? We have a hard time having a tender heart for those who slow us down or get in our way. And as it's the fact, you know, in the church, we're interacting, we're trying to do something, and we got some kind of plan, and then there's a person that slows us down. We're so excited about this plan, and they throw the monkey wrench every time, right? They're the one that gets in the way. They're the one that causes, I have to spend all my time dealing with that problem kid that I have to, oh man, here we go. And it's easy to say, oh yeah, I'm so compassionate for this person in need. I'm going to help them. But there's not really any cost to helping them because, you know, I can just have a few minutes and I'll be compassionate to them. Oh, yeah, I have a tender heart. But you have a tender heart for the person that's getting in your way? The one that's making your job harder? That's what a yielded heart looks like. That's what a tender heart looks like, right? Right? You have so many examples. In the Bible, you know, you can look at Luke 2. Mary and Joseph, right? They come and find Jesus, and he was doing what he was supposed to be doing in the temple. And they said, "And why is thou? Didn't you know we were looking for you?" And of course, they understood not. And Jesus said to them, "How is it that ye sought me? Wist you not that I was about my Father's business?" Right? They didn't understand. Jesus is doing what he's supposed to be doing, and here Mary and Joseph went, "No, we want you to come with us to Nazareth." But look what it says. And he came to Nazareth and was subject to them. Jesus let Mary get in his way. He was already doing at the age of 12 what his life's calling was. And yet he had a tender enough heart to step out of that and have a tender heart for Mary and Joseph who didn't understand. Now, people that are often frustrating you in the church often don't even understand that they're frustrating you, right? But now, of course, sometimes they do, right? Sometimes it is on purpose, right? Back in Acts 17, right after, he preached at Mars Hill, there come these people, right, saying, what will this babbler say, right? There are people talking against you. There are people that might even come to church, and they might be having a bad day, and they might think, I want to get in your way. I used to have a yielded heart for them. What did Jesus do? Here he is to save the Jews. He came unto his own, right? They didn't receive him. They crucified him. In Luke chapter 23, one on the right hand, one on the left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they parted his raiment and cast lots. You talk about frustrating. Here's the King of Kings being mocked by the priest. He's coming to save them, and they're beating him and nailing him to the cross. Now, let me ask you, have you gotten that level of opposition from members of this church? When's the last time another member of this church put a bag over your head and then punched you and said, ha, if you're really a prophet, tell me who just hit you? When's the last time a member of this church put a nails through your hand and left you hanging outside somewhere to die? If Jesus can say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, when they're directly opposing everything he's doing, can't you do the same for someone who doesn't understand and they want to do their Sunday school classroom their way, and so you have to spend a bunch of time dealing with them, and you have to put the things over here not the way you want to do it, and they're getting in your way, and they turn the thermostat the wrong way, and they misplaced your vacuum cleaner, or whatever it is, I don't know, I'm making this stuff up, right? And there's frustrating people in the church, and you're frustrated with them. But they haven't nailed you to the cross yet. So, like Christ, kind of say, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Number three, you have a tender heart for struggling people. For struggling people. We lack a tender heart for those who are struggling long after they should have learned. Sure, we see someone coming in off the street and they've got problems and they're hearing about Christ for the first time and we have this huge open heart for them. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. But then here's the member that's been in this church for years and they've heard that sermon. They've heard that sermon five times. And yet they're still doing it. What are you thinking? They even said, I'm going to do better at this. I'm going to do better at this. And then they backslide. And somehow in our mind, we justify not having a tender heart for them because they should have known better. But I should have known better. And Christ has a tender heart for me. Right? You even look in the Bible, how many struggling people, they should have known better. Look at Jesus talking to his apostles, right? It says in John 14, Philip saith unto him, show us the Father, and suffice us. Jesus saith unto him, have I been so long time with you, and yet thou hast not known me, Philip? I mean, Philip should have known the answer to this question by now. He's heard it, Jesus say it time and time again, and yet he still hasn't gotten it. And you know what? Jesus still loved Philip, still had a tender heart for him, and still died on the cross for him. So if God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven us, even when we're still struggling on things we should have figured out a long time ago. You know, you've been a Christian for enough years, you should have gotten this one by now, but you're still struggling on it. Why am I so impatient with others that I, you know, I told them what to do and they still haven't done it, you know? I went and talked to my spouse and they're still struggling, right? So this struggling thing, listen, there are struggling people in our community. And we just talked about, like York County is going on the second domestic murder-suicide in the last 2 days. Just maybe there's some struggling families in our community. Right? If we're seeing that sort of thing, how many families are struggling in ways you can't imagine, and it hasn't escalated to the point where the police surround the building yet. There are some struggling families. And if I don't have a tender heart for struggling people in this room, how could I ever have a tender heart for a struggling neighbor? I'm glad people had a tender heart for people in my family. I've heard many times the story of my grandfather, how my family got to hear about Christ. Right, he was had a struggling marriage. And by the way, I could have said this whole sermon on not how to get along in an imperfect church. I could have written it how to get along in an imperfect marriage. Because it's all the same steps. And my grandpa's house was not a peaceful, wonderful place. There was drinking, there was cussing, there was smoking. He was this wild cowboy living out in Wyoming, doing everything. You picture the stereotypical drinking, smoking, a rough cowboy. And that was my grandpa, right? And he got drunk one too many times and physically abused the wife and kids too many times. And she said, I got to leave. And he comes home, his wife and kids are gone. And they've left because of him. And he finally hit that rock bottom. There's a lot of people could, sounds like, God, she left, you're a problem, you know? You know, she should have left, right? There was a Baptist preacher. He didn't have a hard heart. And when he called out in that hour of need, the Baptist pastor came and gave him the gospel. And of course, how all my aunts and uncles tell the story like this. This preacher, you know, it's a good old-time preacher, right? Puts his finger in my grandpa's face and said, Mr. Meyer, you need to get right with God. That was his solution, you know. How do I get my wife to come back? And he just pointed his finger and said, you need to get right with God. And he said, well, that doesn't sound like a tender heart. No, it was. Because he knew the kind of man my grandpa was. And that was exactly what he needed to be told. And he humbled himself, and he got saved that day. And it took some time, but my grandmother got saved, and the family got saved. And he went and poured all his booze down the drain, threw out all the cigarettes, took the records, you know, the music and that had cuss words on it and stuff, and he broke them in pieces and threw them in the trash can. He got saved and changed the destiny of my family. You know, he sold the ranch, went to Bible college, became a pastor and a missionary. And now here I am, a third generation pastor, and the fourth generation is growing up in this church, learning about, they're over there in Kids Club right now, learning the Word of God. Because someone had a tender heart. And yet there are people like that walk into this church every Sunday. And they're struggling. And they need you to have a tender heart. I want to end with one last thing. I know I've gone a little long, everybody. One more thing here. One more question. And this is probably the hardest one. Sure, I need to have a tender heart for those strange people, the weird ones. They're not like me, right? Or maybe I'm the weird one. I'm like, well, that's, I guess, how it is, right? I got a big tender heart for strange people, right? And for those frustrating people that they're the ones that are getting in my way, right? I have to have a tender heart for struggling people. Here's the hardest one. I have to have a tender heart. Do I have a tender heart? For familiar people. The hardest to have a tender heart for is those we know the best. Because it's one thing you see someone walk in the door and you see the results of their struggle and you have compassion. But it's another thing when you know them well enough that you know it's their fault that they're struggling. Then all of a sudden you lose that compassion. When you know someone long enough, you know how many times they said they'll get better and they didn't. You know how many times they oh, I'm so sorry, and then they've done it again. And little by little, to those closest to us. Now, to get close to you, they took a risk. They made themselves vulnerable by becoming your friend or your spouse. So now you know all their flaws. And that's the hardest group to keep a tender heart for, by far. Look for Jesus' life. Remember, he went back to Nazareth? And now Jesus was perfect. And he thought, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't Mary and his brothers and sisters? And I know they have issues. Right? They weren't thinking about Jesus' issues because he was perfect, but they were thinking about all the things that Joseph did wrong and Mary did wrong and his brother and Jesus' half-brothers and sisters did wrong. And he was not without honor except in his homeland. Right? Where did Jesus get the least respect? Where people knew him the best. And he was sinless. Why do we have the least patience for those closest to us? But Christ knows you intimately. And he still has a tender heart for you. He knows the things you think of, that if your wife knew what you were thinking. But he knows. And yet he still has a tender heart for you. He knows the thoughts that, boy, if your friends knew what you did when no one was looking, he knows you closer than anyone. And so can I have a tender heart for those close to me? So Peter came, and he said, Lord, how oft, this is Matthew 18, shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times? We know the story, right? No, 70 times seven. But notice this, how oft shall my brother sin against me? It's not really a meaningful question, how oft shall some stranger sin against me? They're probably only going to get a chance to sin against you once, okay? Maybe once or twice. But your brother might sin against you 70 times seven times because you're familiar with him. And that's where little by little that debt stacks up. 70 times seven is Jesus saying, okay, see, here's what Peter was thinking. Oh, they say, I'm sorry, I forgive you. But what he didn't mean, forgive me. What he meant is, I stack it up. When the debt reaches seven, then forget it, the debt is due. Get out of my life. But was there ever forgiveness? Here's the thing about that. 70 times seven times, if you've counted all the way till 70 times seven times, and that's how many times your spouse, you know, broke their word, or this church member was mean to you, you count that many times, guess what? Even if you count seven times, that means you've forgiven him zero times. Because the entire concept of forgiveness is that your balance goes back to zero. If you've even counted that, oh, they've wronged me three times, okay, that means you've forgiven him zero times. And you're not forgiving, you're just letting the debt stack up, right? And then Jesus gives this story that we're familiar with, right? There's this man, he had not much to pay, right? And the Lord commanded him to be sold as a slave, and his wife and his children were sold as slaves. And he fell down before him and worshiped him, said, Lord, have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. Look at this. And the Lord of that servant was moved with compassion. He had a tender heart. And he loosed him, look at this, and forgave him the debt. That's not even what he asked for. What he asked for was, give me some more time to pay. But that's not what the Lord did. The Lord forgave him, in which ways, you don't have more time to pay. You never have to pay. You owe me nothing. That is what Christ is asking us to do. What happens in churches if we don't do that? Everything's going great, but little by little, we acquire debts. One glance, one annoyance, one thing said wrong, one misunderstanding, one, oh, you got my parking spot, you're sitting in my seat, right? You cut in line at the potluck, heathen, sinner, oh, I can't believe this is happening in the church, right? Little by little, we let ourselves build up a debt towards someone in the church that we're more and more annoyed with, we think less and less of. And they've owed this huge debt. And Jesus says, no, tender-hearted, forgiving one another. Right? So how do I thrive in an imperfect church? Be kind one to another, tender-hearted, even if they're strange or frustrated or struggling or familiar. That's going to create an environment where I can thrive. That allows me to thrive in this environment. But here's the amazing thing. When I do that, not only will I thrive, but I will create the optimum environment for them to thrive as well. And that's how you can thrive in an imperfect church.